Morning. May it please the court, Adam Caldwell for petitioner Washington Gas Light Company. The critical issues and questions regarding the safety risks posed to Washington Gas by the Cove Point expansion have not changed since Washington Gas was before this court in its appeal of Cove Point 1. The Cove Point expansion more than doubles the amount of LNG, regasified LNG, I'll just call it LNG from here on out, that can flow from Cove Point. Flowing more LNG is the whole point of that expansion. The record shows that exposure to Cove Point's gas causes unsafe leaks in Washington Gas's system, which is literally Cove Point's next-door neighbor. It's the first place the gas goes. This court gave FERC a very practical job to do on remand, which was address this safety issue, and FERC did not do it. Washington Gas is still at risk of harm from the Cove Point expansion, and as such still has the standing that it had before this court in the first case.
Safety issue. FERC says they did address the safety issue.
They didn't address the safety issue. Here's the only thing they did. They took the order that you vacated and they imposed one new condition. They said, we're not going to go back through this whole order. We're going to impose one new condition. And that new condition is we're going to impose a 530,000 decatherm cap on LNG flows to the Columbia pipeline at the Loudoun, Virginia interconnect. Now, that 530,000 cap bears no relation to anything in the record. What they said they did that to ensure that the expansion would not result in any additional flows going there. But it doesn't do any such thing. And what's worse is that the factual underpinning for the idea that they could do just this one new condition was that there would be operational isolation from Washington Gas's system, from gas flowing from Transco. Well, there's a problem with that. And FERC asks you to rely on that operational isolation in its brief, saying that delivery points from Transco to Washington Gas have been isolated from all LNG source supplies. That's not true, because in September 2009, FERC approved an expansion of Transco's system to carry more LNG from an expanded Elba Island, Georgia facility.
This is 2000, what, when was it?
September 2009.
So it's after the hearing.
It's after all the decisions. It's after all this happened.
How do we look at something that happened afterwards?
Because it's a published opinion from the FERC.
You know, I got that part, but we can only look at, I hadn't thought about this before, but under the statute, we can only look at an objection made to the FERC in the first place. So if your argument is that this order is inconsistent with something they did later, how do we get to look at it today?
Because the factual premise they're asking you to rely on, that they came to you and asked you to rely on, is that they only needed to impose this one condition because there's operational isolation from Transco.
But
they flip-flopped on it in subsequent orders.
Well, haven't we said before, in fact, I have thought about this before rather explicitly, that where there's, counsel is arguing inconsistency between the order before the court and a later order, that is a ground for another panel to perhaps examine or set aside the later order on another day, that you do not set the view and order as being erroneous because it is inconsistent with something that happened later. That inconsistency is going to affect the validity of the later order. Is that not what we've held on more than one occasion?
Yes, but in this instance, it goes to not the condition, but the factual premise for the condition, and the fact is gone, okay? And this also goes to the standing issue that interveners raise alone. They suggest that, well, this has all been solved, but in fact it hasn't been solved.
I'm not quite clear on your standing. And I'm not saying I'm ruling against you on it or even inclined against you. But could you tell us specifically what the issue is caused by this order that we can, what the injury is caused by this order that we can redress in this hearing?
Absolutely. The injury is to allow the Cove Point expansion to go forward in a way that ensures not that Washington Gas won't be exposed to more LNG.
That's not addressing. First, what's the injury? How are you hurt by this order?
The injury is that it will cause more unsafe gas leaks, just like the court found the last time that it did cause unsafe gas leaks.
That's not exactly what we found last time.
That's not what the opinion said.
Yeah, we Reviewed the FERC's finding that your hot tar had actually caused the gas leaks, but we did say that FERC had not adequately addressed the safety concerns, so we sent it back for them either to explain or fix, whichever was appropriate after their further proceedings.
Right.
Any event, getting back to the injury, your injury is what? Now, it may be a fact that this will cause more LNG, low HHC LNG to flow, but how does that hurt you? How does the order cause you injury?
The order under review here, how does it cause injury? It increases the risk of additional unsafe gas leaks occurring right here in this area, in Washington Gas's service territory.
And what is the remedy that we should impose that will cure that injury?
The remedy right now, the immediate remedy, obviously, is to send it back to do what they didn't do the first time.
Send it back to do what? Now,
sending it back,
that doesn't fix your injury. I'm trying to find out what it is that is within our jurisdiction in this hearing and within FERC's jurisdiction in this proceeding that will solve your problem.
That
is an element of standing.
The remedy is to go back and impose a limit at Columbia, of a limit of 31,000 decatherms of LNG.
Can they do that in this proceeding? This is a Section 7?
Absolutely.
Or does there have to be a Section 5 proceeding for them to do that?
No, it's this came up. Let's remember when this came up. In 2005, when the application was applied for, shortly after the application was applied for, Washington Gas had evidence that this LNG flow hurt their system. And so they came into this and objected to the expansion. And FERC said, we can consider that, and we have an obligation, and this court confirmed that. So nothing has changed since then.
They certainly can consider a factor, but FERC's argument seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the number they draw, and there may be an arithmetic error, it may not be the correct one, but the number they're drawing there is drawn from pre-existing rights that were established in other proceedings, and that they cannot change that to the detriment of the shipper without a Section 5 proceeding. Do you understand that to be their argument?
I understand that to be their argument.
Yeah. Well, and why isn't it correct?
I understand it to be wrong, too. It's wrong based on this court's precedent in Arizona Corporation Commission case. That was a Section 7 proceeding, and that was a situation in which the court changed the delivery rights of shippers in order to protect the public interest and over the shippers' objections, including the objection that the shippers had spent something, I think, like $1 billion in reliance on those earlier rights. Section 5 itself says that the FERC can look into this issue and that the FERC has the ability, sua sponte, on its own motion, to open a Section 5 proceeding. And so in order to comply, if FERC really believed our hands are tied, we can't do anything because of the shippers' rights here, and we can't address those rights in a 7 proceeding, this court said address safety. So to comply with the court's mandate, they had the mechanism to do that, and that was to open a Section 5 proceeding.
Can I ask you?
Go ahead.
Assume for the purposes of this question that the 530,000 decatherms is correct. That is, that's what the firm delivery agreement was. I appreciate you have a factual sort of interpretation of a contract objection to that, but assume for the moment that it is. If there were no expansion at Cove Point, could Cove Point, as it is currently configured, flow that much gas to WGL?
Well, there's nothing in the record to suggest.
There's nothing in the record to suggest it can't, is there? When you say increased flow, it's increased over the present where, because of demand, flow is low. But FERC's argument is, as I understand it, is that the expansion itself is not what's going to cause 530,000 decatherms to come to WGL, that Cove Point, as it's currently stands, could do that. Now, are you saying there's a factual dispute about that question?
Absolutely, and this is part of the problem with the truncated proceedings that FERC engaged in on remand in order to get out an order before the court's mandate.
Where can you point us in your evidence in the record or even in your argument that physically The current Cove Point couldn't flow 530,000 decatherms.
That's not in the record. I mean, that's part of the problem.
You haven't put anything in the record either.
It should be explored.
You haven't put anything in the record either.
No, we haven't put anything in the record either on that specific issue, I don't believe. But what is in the what is clear is this. First of all, those contracts where that's they're claimed to get
I know
the
530,
they're not in the
record. Leave aside the contracts for a moment. Assume it's true. That is, assume that also, that physically Current Cove, without the expansion, could flow 530,000 decatherms, and that they have a right to receive that under firm contracts. Then I take it you would agree that FERC is correct. That as long as you can't do any more than 530,000, the expansion is not the cause.
I wouldn't say so, because the at-risk stations here at Rockville and Drainsville are at the Columbia-Loudoun Interconnect. And what's clear in the record there is Columbia-Loudoun, they only have takeaway capacity of 97,000 decatherms.
That seems to me yet a different question. They're only going to have that takeaway capacity no matter what the expansion is. Mm-hmm. So even if, you know, they try to flow 10 billion decatherms, they will say, we can't, you know, we're going to stop at 97. That's not, again, that has nothing to do with the expansion.
But this is also part of the problem, because there's FERC didn't explain why it didn't consider the cap that we suggested when the takeaway, and did put the cap that it did when but there's no takeaway there.
Put into English.
And it's not clear in the record that the 97,000 is safe either, yeah. Your Honor.
Could you put in English what you mean when you say takeaway capacity? What does that mean? I realize that's already in English.
How much they can move on
right.
Beyond that point.
Right. So even, I don't understand why the expansion, even if it is correct that there is more, that there are more decatherms coming up to the point, if they can't move on more, they can't move on more. So there won't be more than the 97 that moves on, no matter how much is pushed up to that point.
But is
that correct?
What correct? That
what I just said, correct. If there's a 97,000 limit, there is.
We do not know, because the FERC didn't develop this, and it should have.
I'm talking about with respect to the logic of your argument. If it is correct that there is a bottleneck such that only 97 can flow, then it doesn't matter how much Cove Point expands. Tell me why that would be wrong, not as a matter of fact, but as a matter of logic.
Well, first of all, that could change. That condition could change, and we don't know what might happen. And there's nothing in the record to say that amount of gas flowing there, even at 97, would be safe. Because the FERC said our hands are tied. We can't really tell you what's safe. We can only tell you we don't have jurisdiction to do less than this number. Now, even if the 530 number was a limitation, I would say remand is still required for the following reasons. There's no evidentiary basis for the 530,000 limitation. The contracts are not in the record. And as I said before, FERC could have...
That brings me back to the question I alluded to in passing. It seems that you're saying the 530 is an arithmetic error, that you can't add up the current contracts and get 530?
We've never seen the contracts.
Yeah, FERC has never given us what the arithmetic support is for the 530. I'm going to very arbitrarily and capriciously request that counsel for each side, intervener can do this too if you'd like, give us just a two-page document in the way of a 34J letter or something similar that says why this number is or is not correct. Now, if you do not have access to those contracts and you can't dispute it, tell us that we don't know whether it's right or not. But FERC, please give us some numbers that will show where you got that from, because my colleagues may have found it. I haven't. I'm not at all clear after going through this record whether that's the correct number or not.
Judge, that's the problem with what happened on remand. They didn't get into it. They vetted an obstacle, and then they hid behind it. One last point, and I would say, is this. They had an obligation, and I had intended to save more time for rebuttal, so I'll make this the last point on this.
As we've said before, we don't save time for rebuttal here. If you run out, you run out. And we usually give you back a couple of minutes. But I used to argue in other circuits that did save the time, but we don't. So.
Appreciate that. If FERC truly couldn't address, as it claims, this safety issue comprehensively, then its choice was to deny the expansion. If it couldn't get into that 530 issue that Judge Garland raises, if it couldn't
didn't petitioner also have a choice to petition for a Section 5 proceeding?
Well, it was a choice that wouldn't have made much sense, Your Honor. Yes. Did we have a choice? The answer is yes. Would it have made any sense? No, it wouldn't have. Were we required to do it? No, because we timely protested this Section 7 proceeding when the expansion came up, and that was our objection to the expansion. I'd also...
Well, you've known for some time that FERC is contending that they can't do it in a Section 7. Would it not have seemed a prudent precaution to have filed a Section 5?
To be honest, not with the shell game that I referred to earlier with the Transco proceeding. Mm-hmm. We would have seen an argument that, well, you know, now this is moot because you've started this Section 5 proceeding, and we'd be another two.
I understand the green downside that your client may not have wanted to fund two proceedings, but beyond that, what's the other downside, if any, to filing the Section 5? You may tell me why you think it wouldn't have succeeded, as a better precaution, other than the cost, which I'm sure is significant, but...
We'd be another 2 or 3 years down the road to getting this important issue resolved.
Well, but you're asking for a remand.
I don't see how you'd be any further down the road. You'd be running tandem to this, in which you're arguing this should be the primary vehicle. FERC would be arguing the Section 5 should be the primary vehicle. If you lose now in this and then start your Section 5, you're a whole lot further down the road. So I really don't see the downside to have begun the Section 5 that FERC argues for.
Perhaps, Your Honor, but at the end of the day, we're not required to do it, and we think we're properly here on that. Now, you will hear on this from the interveners, I'm sure, about hexane conditioning.
Before we, you're running out of time, so give me a chance to ask a question.
Okay.
Did you argue, I'm still on the 530 question, right? At JA-22 in the FERC's opinion, they explain how they reached the 530,000 number. Did you challenge below the way in which the delivery rights add up to 530,000?
Again, they're not delivery rights if they can't be nominated and accepted, confirmed.
Right. Did you make that argument below?
Yes.
Where? Can you tell me where?
I'll find it while I sit
and
down.
Did you cite anything when you made those arguments?
I will.
That is, cite any the contract. I mean, your point was that the contracts aren't in evidence. How do you make those kind of points without citing to contracts?
Well, it's the process of, I mean, this is FERC business. This is the process of nominating and confirming shipments that must happen. And, you know, when shipments are nominated, there has to be a process by which it can be determined that they can be received. And I can find argument in that in the record, I'm sure. With that, let me reserve the rest of
Why don't you look for that when you come back up?
I'll look for that.
We'll give you back. We'll round you up to 3 minutes for rebuttal, I'm sure. Hear from the respondent.
Good morning. Judith Albert for the commission. I'd like to respond first to counsel's comment about FERC playing a shell game in the Transcon proceeding. As a matter of fact, the commission addressed Washington Gas's concerns in that proceeding. The commission found that the regasified LNG that will be shipped over the Transcon lines will originate several hundred miles in a few states away from Washington Gas, and that the regasified LNG will be mixed with sufficient domestic gas so that there will be no problem with Washington Gas pipelines. Now, I have to say also that the commission has recently issued an order on rehearing on this. The only rehearing request that I recall was Washington Gas's. Washington Gas is now free to come to this court if they believe that the Transcon proceeding causes them a difficulty. Again, though, I would also emphasize that really the Transcon proceeding has nothing to do with this case. The issue in this case is whether the commission fully addressed whether the expansion can go forward without causing unsafe leakage. And as I think the decisions demonstrate, the commission has done this. I'd also like to address the question about the 530,000.
Yeah, I see it in the footnote to which Judge Garland referred there, and it will add up to the right number. I think I misread it before, but excuse me.
Thank you for finding a footnote, but I'm going to refer you to something else, JA 983. After the remand, the commission issued data requests to the parties, and the Cove Point data responses at JA 983 discusses the $530,000. An additional source of information on the amount of contracts involved in the reactivation can be found in the reactivation decisions, which are cited, I believe, in the original Cove Point orders. And I think as originally envisioned, there would be something like $750,000 decatherms per day going through, and the contracts, according to the Cove Point data responses, are now about $530,000.
The 983 just gives the total, but I think the footnote that Judge Garland referenced does give the components of it.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to emphasize that the only issue here was whether or not the commission complied with the court's remand.
Well, that's not the only issue. Can I ask the same question that I asked? Is the commission's idea that regardless of the expansion, that Cove Point still had the capacity before the expansion to flow 530,000 decatherms, and therefore the expansion doesn't matter?
Yes, it is. And for this, I refer you to, to the rehearing order, paragraph 65, JA 52, where the commission stated that Cove Point has a physical capability to deliver the full amount without the expansion.
Okay, so that goes to the amount. Now, what about to the type, that is, the blend of the gas? Their argument, I take it, is that this particular gas that's going to come in is going to be more problematic for their seals. Is FERC's position that that this 530,000 that physically could have been flowed before the expansion is also of the same blend?
The 530,000 that could have flowed before the expansion,
yes,
was the regasified LNG that would come from the original pre-existing Cove Point LNG facilities.
Is that imported and
yes,
therefore
that's
so it has the same, whatever the problem is, if there is a problem of the imported gas, this is all that happens with the expansion is more gas becomes available at Cove Point, but not a different kind of gas?
That's correct.
Okay. Let me ask one more question. When FERC says that we don't have any authority over the intrastate, the local system, and that we can't make them fix it or anything like that, are you also saying that we can't take into consideration what the consequence of flowing more or different gas would be in the interstate pipelines, even if it would cause a safety problem in the local? Or are you just saying that it's not going to be a problem?
FERC is not saying at all that it has no concern over safety. Of course, FERC has to consider safety.
Even in the local?
What FERC is saying is that it cannot, in the paragraphs you quoted, FERC is simply saying that it cannot tell Washington Gas to build a hexane station or to close off a valve or to repair its system. FERC responded to this court's, let me back up. First, in the original proceeding, the commission addressed safety and said that it believed that Washington Gas could complete its repairs before the expansion became operational. This court found that that was not based upon substantial evidence. So in the first case, the commission did consider safety. The court disagreed with it. And on remand, the commission's obligation was to more fully address whether the expansion could go forward safely. And the commission did this. It received more evidence. It looked at all the ways that the gas would not get into Washington Gas.
I just want to understand your idea of what your jurisdiction includes, because the other side contends that what you're saying is that all that matters to FERC or all that FERC has authority over is what flows interstate, and even if the consequence is a mega disaster, once you get to the local, FERC's view is it doesn't have authority. Now, you're telling me that that's not your position.
No, in fact, the commission...
It's not your position, right? No, when you say FERC, no, when you say no, yeah, you mean?
No.
FERC in the past has denied applications for certification for LNG facilities when it believed that safety was not adequately protected. So FERC will look at safety first. If the safety issues are not resolved, FERC will not grant the certification.
Right, so let me just give you a hypothetical, okay? So imagine that the interstate pipeline, everything is fine, can handle it, no safety problem at all, flows into WGL, and you know that there is a break in the WGL line, which they don't have enough money to fix. And all the gas will spill all over everything. There'll be a huge conflagration, and Washington will disappear. Is your position that that doesn't matter from not that it doesn't matter, but you have no jurisdiction to consider whether the gas should continue to flow through the interstate pipeline, since your only concern, your only jurisdiction is over the interstate?
No, our position is that with regard to Washington Gas's piping, your hypothetical breaking open, if Washington Gas wants to fix it, that's fine. If they want the gas to keep on flowing, that's not our jurisdiction. It's the jurisdiction of local authorities. What the commission has authority to do is to tell the interstate gas line to stop delivering
gas. You don't doubt that you could say, stop delivering the gas. We know your interstate pipeline is safe, but there are people on the other end who are not being responsible, and we're not going to have a disaster.
That's correct.
Okay.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. We'll hear from the intervener. I usually forget the interveners. I'm doing better this time.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Christopher Hanman for the interveners. Let me clarify first, Judge Garland, your question about the physical capacity of Cove Point to flow. Ms. Albert pointed to one aspect of that reference. In the initial remand order at footnote 45, page 24 of the joint appendix, the commission expressly notes exactly the physical capacity. It's 675,000 decatherms that already exist in Cove Point can deliver
footnote,
to Columbia.
I'm sorry.
Footnote 45 at page 24 of the joint appendix. And what that footnote
points to. You know, you all might all think about when you want us to read things, put them up where our eyes are. You know, if the Lord had meant for us to read footnotes, he would have put our eyes on a vertical axis rather than horizontal.
Okay, I got it, though. Thank you.
Exactly. The other aspect that there was a question about was where did the 530 number come from? Now, Ms. Albert, again, pointed exactly to where that source is, page 983, which was a data response. I suspect one of the rebuttal arguments will be that's just a data response. How can FERC rely on it? They can rely on it because it's a sworn statement, and you can see the sworn verification at the previous page, page 92.
Shouldn't there be some underlying documents of contract somewhere that would give these numbers without having to rely on these statements?
Only if it's been challenged. If WGL at any point had suggested there was a flaw with the 530 number. This was obviously a data response. There was plenty of surrebuttals and rebuttals going back and forth. If they had an objection or thought there was some reason to question that figure, they could have said so. And the commission presumably would have then issued a data response saying, deliver those. To the extent this court is concerned, we'd be happy to under seal to submit those contracts. But the whole reason we never...
Don't do that yet, but you might want to find out where they are.
Okay. That clarifies the two of the key components of FERC's order and shows why there is no ongoing safety concerns. The other aspect that helps guarantee why there is no safety issue is in footnote 44 of the commission's order. That's at page 23 of the joint appendix. What that footnote points out...
I'm sorry, say it again.
It's footnote 44, page 23 of the joint appendix. What that footnote demonstrates is that the entire expansion volume, that's to say the entire extra 800,000 decatherms that's being approved here in these orders, is being routed on a primary firm basis to two pipelines, Dominion and Transco, not Columbia. And Columbia is indisputably the only pipeline that can cause any problems for WGL. Because as the commission noted, because the primary flows are directed to those two pipelines, it will not, quote, affect WGL's safety. That's one of the key findings also of the commission. And again, it's a point that we raised on intervener's brief as a matter of standing. It factors into the merits question. And it's a point that WGL has never contested. It is indisputable. Now, they have, as a late-breaking argument, suggested there is some dispute about whether Transco still to this day can safely carry that gas. But let's be clear, not only is that an objection to an order not before this court, it's an objection to LNG deliveries from an entirely different system. It has nothing to do with deliveries of LNG from Cove Point. The only question is the safety of deliveries of Cove Point, and it remains undisputed that there is a tap on the Transco pipeline that prevents any deliveries at this point into the WGL system.
Can I ask you, before you burn up all your time, you raise a standing argument. You're really the only one who raised a standing argument, so I want to see if I understand, and particularly the arguments that you heard back and forth with the Chief Judge. Your standing argument sounds very much like the merits argument, right? Almost identical.
It's very similar.
Right. Your argument is that they only have FERC only has authority with respect to the expansion, right? Not with respect to the pre-expansion, and therefore they can't remedy the solution. But their argument is no, they have they have authority pre-expansion, which you disagree with. But second, their argument is that in the expansion hearing, they have authority under Section 7 or under Section 5, right, to cut off more flows, right? That's their argument. They have legal authority to do that, right? So our normal approach in standing is that we assume that the petitioner's legal claim is correct. Correct? I'm right about this, right? And then we go on, and if they are correct, we ask whether a resolution from this court and therefore from the agency would remedy. We don't go to the question of whether or not they are correct till you get to the merits. Otherwise, we would decide standing merits during standing, right?
That's correct.
So why is this a standing and not a merits issue?
It's a standing issue principally on the injury in fact question. And there...
Well, that's not... The main source of your argument is about... So you give up on the remedy. Agree that the question of whether it's whether we can remedy it is a merits question.
No. We raised both a redressability problem, but our first argument was...
Well, let's start with your second argument then, because that was the most interesting. The redressability argument, right?
The redressability argument turns on the idea that if you vacate these orders, this court would not be in a position to impose any caps. It would not be sending anything back for imposition of a cap. The choice it has is to vacate the orders as arbitrary and capricious.
Yes, but that is always our problem in APA cases. We wouldn't, since we can usually not order the agency to do anything but only vacate. If you were right, we would never have standing. There would never be standing. And so we have a whole series of cases that say when you vacate the agency, and if you tell the agency, by the way, you do have authority to do that, that is enough for the standing, because a reasonable agency will reconsider its decision and may come out the way the petitioner wants.
No question. And there, that's why it then folds back onto the injury in fact.
Right, so we're past redressability?
I think so. But here's why they're so very closely related, and that's the idea that you have here a situation in which the undisputed flows on a primary basis are going to two different pipelines. There's no question that if gas doesn't reach Columbia, and we're only talking about expansion volumes, they cannot identify an injury in fact. The only injury they can identify is any volumes, any extra volumes that go to Columbia. They can't do that.
Right. So, but I thought, so now we're in a real question about the difference between merits and standing, right? Everything you're saying sounds like a substantial evidence claim. The FERC's decision points out, as FERC counsel pointed to the page, that says there's a certain physical capacity already. You point that out. So now the question is there substantial evidence to support that? I guess we could think about that as sufficient substantial evidence for the injury in fact, or we could think about it as sufficient substantial evidence the other way, but
causation.
Does it make any difference here?
Well, I think all roads lead to either a dismissal or a denial of the petition.
That's not usually when you say all roads lead to, that's usually not the way people fill in the last words.
Well, but that's a rather creative metaphor. The point here, of course, under Steel Company, this court is obligated to consider the jurisdiction. And I think here's why that jurisdictional issue matters. And there, this is not uncommon in APA cases. Footnote 10 of this court's United Transportation Union case acknowledged the close relationship. And in an APA case, the question is the agency's decision arbitrary and capricious, apart from whether, in fact, the petitioners can show injury? Now, here, both issues, the footnote 44, the idea that these volumes are flowing to different pipelines, factors into why the commission's decision is obviously not arbitrary and capricious and well-reasoned. But it also underscores a very key problem, which is that they cannot identify the predicate injury in fact to press that. But ultimately, Whether this court resolves that as a threshold question of standing, or as FERC has urged the court and we've endorsed, that this is a well-reasoned agency decision, in neither case can WGL demonstrate that there is a safety issue here and one that the commission has not considered. And to get back finally to Judge Garland, your question about the jurisdiction, I mean, paragraph 49 of the rehearing order of the commission makes quite clear that it will, quote, always consider, end quote, the interests of those local distribution companies. So even though there's an odd statement that they don't have jurisdiction, that they truly do not have jurisdiction, but they are not disavowing the obligation to consider those interests.
What I understood, I agree it's an odd sentence. And that's the reason I asked for counsel. And her interpretation of the sentence is the one that I must say I also thought, which was, don't have jurisdiction to order WGL to do something, but do have jurisdiction with respect to the interstate pipeline, if there were going to be a safety problem that could not otherwise be resolved, to order the interstate to do something. Is that correct? That's how you read it as well?
That's absolutely correct. Now, it's paragraph 47 where they make that reference to a lack of jurisdiction. But in the same course, what they emphasize is what that means is they cannot monitor and they cannot compel. That's all very true. But that's at the same time not suggesting that they're going to ignore the problems and potential safety concerns. That's made clear two paragraphs later at paragraph 49. So because WGL cannot establish their standing and because the agency's decision is well-reasoned, we would suggest the petition be dismissed. If there are no further questions.
Okay, seeing none.
Thank you.
Okay, what did he have left?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. We'll have 3 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you.
Judge Santel, on the Section 5 question, I should remind the court that the shippers claimed that long ago that Washington Gas should start a Section 5 proceeding. And FERC rejected that concept and said, we can consider your objections to this expansion in this docket. It did that before this case got to the court the last time. That was specifically raised and rejected. And so it was entirely reasonable for...
Where would we find that?
It's in the record.
So are lots of
It's in the record, and hopefully we'll find it before I'm done.
Okay.
But it was a very clear point. It's also briefed, Your Honor. Now, the expansion matters. The entire point of this expansion was to basically double everything. It was to double imports. It was to double storage. Even expand the piers.
So I have two fact questions. One is they pointed out a footnote which says what the physical capacity was, which was 675. Is there a place in the record below where you challenged that? That is an amount higher than the 530.
What the capacity was? No, but what's not in the record is what was actually flowing. And that's why the expansion was a problem. Your Honor, we had in our Prince George's County system a 17-fold increase in...
Why is that a problem from the expansion, though?
It's the problem that says we needed to object to the expansion. Okay. That's the problem.
Expansion caused that.
Right.
No, the expansion didn't cause that. The pre-expansion flows showed us that expansion would be an issue, and it would create safety issues. And that's why the court sent this back once before, to address those safety issues. Now, in a Section 5 proceeding, in this proceeding, FERC can open a Section 5 inquiry on its own in this proceeding. And when this court sent it back and said, you must address safety more fully, it was absolutely just FERC saying, we're not going to comply with the remand.
Does this mean you concede then that what has to be altered is the pre-expansion agreement?
Well, FERC has authority to open.
I'm asking you, do you now concede that that's what the problem is, pre-expansion, not post-expansion?
It's unclear that it has to be, because whatever the capacity is, Judge, it's not clear, and it would certainly seem the evidence suggests that amount never actually flowed. That's what's important here, what the actual flows were, with the limitation.
Why is that important?
I still
don't get why the expansion's related the problem then.
Because the expansion makes it much more likely that this leak-causing low HHC gas will hit our system, which is right, it's like a loaded shotgun, right, pointed right straight at Washington Gas. We are right on top of this.
It happened pre-expansion.
It could have, and it did, which is why we objected to the expansion.
If it did happen pre-expansion, then you have a standing problem.
Up to the same amount.
No, because it happened pre-expansion, and that 530 cap, again, no evidence that that actually flowed. And expansion is stopped, then...
Can you hold for one second?
Yes.
You were going to look for where you disputed that the 530,000 was firm capacity. Did you dispute that?
Yes, JA1313.
Well, I was on 1314. I was close. No. Where was the argument? Where can you point? Because on the next page, you agree, on 1314, you agree that it's the total of the three bilateral contracts. Is there a place
right,
on here?
Right there, right at JA1313, we argued that there was no evidentiary basis for the 530,000.
No, really? You say there's no evidentiary basis for the Commission's conclusion that this condition will permit Washington Gas to operate safely.
There's no evidentiary basis for the condition.
What I was looking for was the argument that you're making here was in this court is that the 530,000 is not really firm, right?
That's correct.
And that's what I was looking for, where that's made below. That's all.
Right, but we point out that they're not in the record at that time.
What you point out there is that there's no record that will permit the gas, Washington Gas, to operate safely. It's not a challenge to the accuracy of the numbers so far as firm capacity, is it?
Or, maybe I'm reading it incorrectly, Your Honor.
And, maybe I am, but the sentence, however, there is no evidentiary basis for the Commission's conclusion that this condition will permit Washington Gas to operate its system safely. Do you somewhere say that that's not the number that accurately reflects firm contract?
This is also at, now I'm at page 25 of our initial brief. No, it's the initial, where we said that based on the operations of the...
Now, you're talking about your brief in this court.
Yes.
What we're trying to find is in the record where you challenged the accuracy of the 530,000 during the administrative proceedings. I think...
Yes. Right, and in that we go through at footnote 68 a number of record sites to support the argument that that these contracts are not entitlements to deliver 530,000 decatherms.
Can you point me right now to where in the record we would best find where you raised below the inaccuracy of that 530,000 figure as firm? And let me also say that a brief that has well over 100 footnotes in it is asking for an awful lot of what's in it not to get read.
We point to the tariffs, and that's, again, at page 68 of this initial brief.
No, just to be clear, I think this footnote is quite important if you raise the point below. So you have a lot of evidence here that you're asking us to look at, and the question I had was, did you make this argument? Not is this evidence in the record.
Did you raise this question below? And that 1313 raises the question of whether there's a basis for the conclusion that the condition would permit safety in operation.
I'm not saying you didn't raise it.
It doesn't challenge the
number. I just don't know.
Appreciate that. I'm unable to put my finger on it right this moment, but I can supplement with it.
Okay, so each side send us two pages on this question of 530,000. Nobody.
It's a long record. We understand why it's a problem.
I think that exhausts everybody's time now.
Including the court.
Including the court. Do you all need a break before we go into the other one? Okay, this case is submitted. Call the next case.